Ladies and gentlemen, again, welcome to today's Bit Information webcast. This webcast is related to the IPA's non-solar community renewables RFP. My name is Benjamin Chi. I'm with NERA as the procurement administrator for this RFP. Presenting with me is Dr. Chantal Lacasse, as well as Ms. Katie Olandi from NERA, and Mr. Anthony Starr, the director of the IPA. A few housekeeping items, and for those of you who have just joined, first, the presentation itself is based on draft requirements and contract terms that have already been posted to the procurement website. Over on the next slide, please. The procurement website address is listed here at the bottom of this slide 2, ipa-energyrfp.com. The materials that were posted were prepared to provide you some visibility on the requirements that are expected in the RFP as well as in the REC contract when they become available at a later time. And the disclaimer that we have here is that while we provide you the draft requirements and provide you this presentation to discuss those draft requirements which are provisional, some of the elements are fixed in Public Act 990906 in the procurement plan of the IPA as well as in the ICC order approving the plan. So those elements that are covered by those governing documents are not expected to change. We are looking for your comments on the draft requirements, and we will talk a little bit about how we're going to get them. If you have any questions throughout this presentation, we ask that you submit your questions using these instructions here. Locate the Q&A on the right side of your screen. Select all panelists in the Ask box. Type in your questions, any slide numbers, and click Send to submit your questions. The presentation itself, the audio recording, the Q&A, again, will be posted on the ipaenergyrfp.com website. And for today's agenda, we will provide you a high-level overview of the process as well as the timing of key events that will be covered by Ms. Katie Olandi. And then Dr. Chantal Lacasse will walk us through the program requirements as well as the bid requirements, and I will lead a discussion on the key contract requirements. We'll have a time for questions at the end of this webcast. And before all of this, I'd like to just invite Mr. Anthony Starr, the director of the IPA, to say a few words about this program. Mr. Starr?
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chi. I'd like to thank everyone for participating in this morning's webcast, and I'll be brief because we do have a lot to cover. So this morning, this is going to be really the first overview of the what's known as the Community Renewable Generation Procurement. This is for community renewable generation projects that are not photovoltaic. As you likely know, community solar project applications are taken either through the Adjustable Block or Illinois Solar for All programs. The reason we're conducting this procurement is that as we develop the long-term renewable resources procurement plan, we observed that the Act called for us to create a community renewable generation program, but it really only created a clear path forward for community solar projects. So we included in the long-term renewable resources procurement plan the proposal, which we're now implementing, to conduct a competitive procurement to allow non-solar community renewable generation projects an opportunity to participate. And that's really why we're here today. This is to sort of understand and give an opportunity for those sorts of projects. Obviously, there's been a lot of attention given to community solar, but since the Act realizes the potential for other sorts of community renewal projects with subscribers, we needed a path forward to allow those to participate. Today's webinar really has two purposes. First is to give an overview of our competitive procurement process. It's a fairly different structure than those of you who participated in either the Adjustable Block program or Illinois Solar for All programs. So we want to sort of provide an overview for how this competitively bid process will work. And then the second is to provide an outline of what the project application requirements are. There's going to be an opportunity to provide feedback on those prior to us finalizing them. but we want to get those out to be, have people begin to digest those and make sure that they're appropriate, and any adjustments that we may need to make as we finalize them, we can take into account your feedback. So I hope you find today's webcast informative, and we do look forward to your feedback. And with that, I'll turn it back to Ms. Orlandi.
Thanks, Anthony, and good morning to everyone. So in this first section, the competitive bidding process, I'm going to go through the timeline with key deadlines, and then I'm going to go through some slides to give a high-level introduction to both the application and the bidding process. So we're going to be conducting two RFPs this fall, the low-income community solar pilot RFP and the non-solar community renewables RFP. These RFPs are entirely separate. They have separate contracts and separate qualification requirements. So this slide really just provides the very basic details that distinguish the two RFPs. In this webcast, we're going to be discussing the non-solar community renewables RFP, and the webcast for the other RFP was held earlier today, and that presentation is going to be posted on our website. So let's start here on the right-hand side of the screen with the non-solar community renewables RFP. Importantly, projects must be non-solar community projects. And generally, the generation types are wind or biodiesel crops and untreated and unadulterated organic waste biomass or tree waste. The project must be less than or equal to 2 megawatts. The requirements for this RFP are based on the adjustable block program. However, it is a competitive bidding process, and what that means is that instead of receiving an administratively determined REC price, applicants are going to submit to us a dollar per REC price that they develop themselves, and then those prices are going to be evaluated against each other, that other bids that are received for qualified projects. So in regards to the other RFP, the low-income community solar pilot RFP, the projects are community solar. There's no size requirement. There's a requirement that the project must result in economic benefits for the members of the community in which it's located and must include a partnership with at least one community-based organization. The requirements for this RFP are based on the Illinois Solar for All program, and again, it's a competitive bidding process. So the procurement website where you're going to find all the documentation and information for this RFP is www.ipa-energyrfp.com. And this slide provides a screenshot of our homepage. And as you can see on the left-hand side, there's a dedicated page for this RFP. This is where you're going to find those draft key contract terms and the preliminary proposal requirements that were posted last night. You click on this link, and then you'd navigate to the draft documents subpage. So as I mentioned, we posted those key contract terms and preliminary proposal requirements yesterday, and this slide provides the comment processes that are coming up in August and September. So by tomorrow, August 1st, we're going to post an invitation to comment on the proposal requirements, and August 29th will be the deadline for submitting those comments. So when we post the invitation tomorrow, we're going to have detailed instructions for how to submit your comments to us. And also by August 30th, the entire draft contract for this RFP is going to be posted to the website. And by September 20th, interested parties can go ahead and submit comments to us. So in regards to the contract, interested parties are going to be able to download a Word version of the draft, and then you'll be able to provide both your comments and red lines for consideration. And again, when we post that draft contract, we're also going to be posting instructions for how to submit to us. So several weeks after the comment process concludes, on October 22nd, we will be posting the final REC contract and the rules for participating in the RFP, and then we'll hold a second webcast on October 24th to go through very thoroughly the final terms and rules and application process. But I want to note here that importantly, as you can see on this calendar, we make reference to both a Part 1 window that opens on October 24th and a Part 2 window that opens on November 20th. And this is because the proposal or the application process is going to be completed in two steps. So during the Part 1 window between October 24th and November 6th, the Part 1 date, applicants will submit the Part 1 proposal in order to meet the qualification requirements. And then on November 19th, applicants will receive a Part 1 notification, which will inform them whether the project has qualified. Next, between November 20th and December 4th, qualified applicants will be able to submit their Part 2 proposal. Importantly, that will include posting bid assurance collateral, which is a requirement that we're going to cover in the next section. On December 13th, bidders will submit their bids, and shortly thereafter, we will be reporting the results of the RFP to the Illinois Commerce Commission, who in turn will decide whether or not to accept the results on December 19th. So on this slide, I just want to highlight two fees that are applicable to the process. So first, there's a bid participation fee of $500 that's paid by bidders to the IPA by the Part 1 date. There is an exception, that is that bidders who have already paid this fee when participating in another IPA procurement event in 2019 will not be required to pay it again. Now, there's also a supplier fee, and it's paid by winning bidders only to the IPA within 7 business days of ICC decision. And the exact amount of the supplier fee will be provided to all qualified applicants prior to the bid date, we would also expect to be providing an estimate of the supplier fee, likely with that next webcast to be held on October 24th. Now, the application process is going to be held online, so that means you're going to be submitting almost all of your application materials through online forms and email. So that means if you are planning to participate, you're going to need to register for an account, and we'll provide you with login credentials. You can register for an account using our website, ipa-energyrfp.com. You'd click on the qualification form link on the left, and then request login credentials here and fill out a short form. Alternatively, you can email illinois-rfp@nero.com and provide the 4 bullet point request for contact here. And also, please indicate that you need an account for this non-solar community renewable RFP. So as I mentioned, the Part 1 and Part 2 proposals are submitted electronically via online forms. You're going to log in, you're going to complete fields and upload supporting documentation. Once you've filled out the form, you'll hit submit. It's a button on the form, and then it'll notify us that you're ready for us to review, and we'll begin evaluating your proposal pretty immediately. If we do find any deficiencies or missing information, we're going to just provide a notice to you, and that notice will provide the next deadline. You'll generally be given to the deadline, either the Part 1 or Part 2 date, or you'll be given 1 to 2 business days to respond. With your proposal, you'll need to provide contact information. You'll provide contact information for the bidder. This is the entity that submits the proposal. And you'll also provide contact information for the seller, which is the entity that's going to sign the REC contract if the project's selected and approved by the ICC. These two entities are not required to be the same. You're going to be asked to name 1 to 4 representatives, and these are the individuals who we're going to contact with questions regarding the project and the proposal. They'll be CC'd on all correspondence from us. You'll also name an officer of the seller, and this is an individual who has the power to undertake contracts to bind the seller. This person is also going to sign all of the required certifications in the Part 1 and Part 2 proposal. So this final slide before I pass the presentation gives a high-level overview of the bid submission process. First, you're going to be submitting your bids to us using an Excel spreadsheet that's provided to you from us, and then you're going to transfer that to the spreadsheet to us through a secure website, and we'll hold a training session for qualified bidders, and we'll provide a guide, and we'll be available to help answer any questions for submitting the form and using our website. Once the bids are received, the procurement administrator, NERA, is going to evaluate the bids, and importantly, only bids that meet or beat a confidential benchmark will be considered, and then those bids that pass are going to be selected on a price-only basis. So with that, I'm going to turn the presentation over to Chantal Lacasse to discuss the preliminary qualification requirements.
Thank you, Katie. Good morning, everyone. In this section, we're going to review some of the requirements for the Part 1 and the Part 2 proposal that Katie mentioned and provided deadlines for on that calendar. Generally speaking, for Part 1, you'll be providing information about the project, the parties involved in the submission of the proposal. For example, the contact information that we've already discussed a little bit is one of the requirements of the Part 1 proposal. In addition to this contact information is information about the project. One is a basic description of the project, including the name that you've assigned to the project, the technology or generation type of the project, as well as the size and kilowatt AC rating. There's going to be a technology specific but standard for that technology capacity factor that's going to be used to estimate production for the project. Now, that being said, and those numbers are not in this presentation, are not yet available, but when we do provide that standard capacity factor for a specific technology such as wind, you will always have the option, if that capacity factor is not suitable for you because your system can support a higher capacity factor, can produce more than that capacity factor would predict, you will have the option to provide documentation and justify use of a higher capacity factor for your project. In addition to basic information about the project, there's also a description of the project site and location. So at a very basic level, providing a complete address for the project, but importantly also providing a map of the project site, showing the property boundaries, structures on the property, the location of the project, and if there's any projects that are other community projects that are located on the same or on a contiguous parcel, to also provide that information on the project map. And we'll see that there are restrictions on co-locations of projects, mainly because there are restrictions on the project size. So that will become important to show on the map. And if there are two co-located projects, then you will be asked for additional information, such as the size of all the projects, and make sure, again, that you indicate those locations on the map. Now, before we go on to the next slide, just want to also say that part of the information that we call project location is to provide the name of the electric utility, municipal utility, public utility, or electric cooperative to which your project is interconnected or will be interconnected if the project has not completed the interconnection stage. So now we can move on to the required documentation for the seller. So there's really two tracks here if you have participated in the adjustable block program and the seller. And again, the seller here, we mean the entity that ultimately would sign the REC contract if the project is selected through this RFP. So if that entity has applied and has already an approved vendor status under the adjustable block program, then that's one possibility, one track here. And in that case, we would be asking for proof of that approved vendor status and a few additional documentation, namely a W-9 form and such as a W-9 form and the statement of good standing from the state of Illinois. Now, the second track or second possibility is that the seller, again, the entity that would sign the REC contract, has not participated or has not gotten a approved vendor status from the adjustable block program. And in that case, we still ask for those same documents, but we'll also ask for additional information, such as the details of the ownership structure, the data formation of the seller, also a confirmation that the seller has a GATS, PJM GATS, or an AMETS account. So there's lots of details here that are not on this slide. So this is really just a few, for example, items that would be required if the seller is not already an approved vendor under the adjustable block program. So we really invite you to consult the documents with the draft requirements so that you can have full information on what we're expecting to ask of you in this regard, and also so that you can provide your comments on those requirements. Going back to the project information for a minute, here there's also several possibilities. If the project is already operating, so that's one case, then we would be asking for the date of first operation. So that's important because one of the requirements for the project is that it be new. And we'll talk more about that when we discuss the key contract terms, but that's the purpose of asking for this piece of information. Also, the GATS or AMRITS ID for the project, where GATS and AMRITS are going to be the tracking system through which RECs would be transferred from the project to the buyer. And finally, a copy of the fully executed interconnection agreement. So that's if the project is already operating. If it's not already operating, there's two possibilities here. First, if there's a fully executed interconnection agreement that is available, then we would ask for a copy of that. If it's not available, then we would be asking or requiring other documentation so that we can have a comparable project maturity to one that would have a fully executed interconnection agreement. In particular, we'll be asking for a copy of the interconnection application. Second, we would be asking about a description of how the project will be financed, and together with that, some letters of intent, either from lenders or equity partners, that would together cover 30% of the expected project financing. And finally, there would be documentation for a given area that may be different for depending on the technology of your project. So there will be additional requirements for your project, or if your project is not a wind project, then you can ask for consideration of the documents that you have for site control. For wind, what we're expecting is to ask for site control for an area that would be 30 times the project size. So that means that if the project is 1 megawatt, then we would ask for site control for 30 acres. So again, that's what we're expecting for wind. For other technologies, we're not expecting to have a formula of that kind. And if there are projects that for which you're going to be submitting proposals, then you can ask for evaluation of your site control documentation, and we will make that determination on a case-by-case basis. If site control documentation is required, let me talk a little bit more about that. So again, that's not always the case. So that's only in the case where your project is not yet operating and you do not have a copy of a fully executed interconnection agreement that you can provide with your proposal. That's the case where certain specific documents are required, including site control documentation. So first I'll say that we'll evaluate whatever documentation you have available to show that you have site control over the area that includes the project site. Here we're just giving you some examples of documentation that you could provide to satisfy this requirement. And that goes all the way from having actual proof that you own the land, so that leaves no doubt that you do have site control, to having a letter of intent from the owner of the land to lease the land to you. And we would provide sample of what that letter of intent could look like. And there could be documents in between, including a signed lease agreement, an option for the land, a memorandum of understanding with the landowner, et cetera. Whatever the document is, there's a few features of those documents that I'd like to call out here of things that we would expect to see to be able to connect the documents that we're seeing that provide control of a certain area with the project for which you're submitting a proposal. The first would be for the document to refer to the parcel, the portion of the project site that is provided on the map so that we can connect geographically the project site with the document that you're providing to show site control. The second, and here I'm mainly talking in the case of the wind project, to provide the acres that are controlled by the landowner so that we can see that it will satisfy the requirements in terms of the area that we're expecting. And finally, we would want to have the site control document name the seller or an affiliated company or another party that's involved in the proposal so that, again, we connect the parties of the proposal to the document that is providing site control. There's going to be, in the Part 1 proposal, so everything I've discussed so far in terms of requirement is all for the Part 1 proposal. And the Part 1 proposal also includes what we call some representations or certifications. So here, those are really going to be commitments or undertakings of the seller in various areas or spheres, including there's going to be a number of regulatory or legal certifications, establishing your good standing and good character. There's commitments and undertakings regarding the project and how the project is defined and the characteristics of the project, including, that, for example, that it is in Illinois, that it does credit or will credit the value of the electricity generated by the project to subscribers. And finally, there are a number of commitments or undertakings regarding the seller, including that the seller understands and accepts the terms of the REC contract, so that's once it's finalized, of course, that there will be no substitution of projects by the seller, and that the seller has title to the RECs, by which we mean has the ability to sell the RECs and transfer the RECs from its own gas or AMRITS account to the account of the buyer. Now, just as was the case when I talked about the details of what's required in terms of information about the seller. These are really just a few four instances of each of those certifications, commitments, and undertakings. And the list of such commitment undertakings or certifications representation is in the draft requirements document that's posted to the website. And so certainly invite you to look at those representation certifications, make sure you understand them, ask any questions you have about them, or provide your comments. Now, moving on to the Part 2 proposal requirements. So again, from Part 1 to Part 2, once you've completed Part 1, you've been successful, then you are invited to provide the second part of the proposal, the Part 2 proposal requirements. That will include providing the marketing materials that you use to promote the project or the participation in IPA program. It does include additional certifications as well, so additional commitments or undertakings by the seller. So, for example, you will be submitting a bid, and in your Part 2 proposal, you will commit to those bids, if you have several projects, remaining valid until 17 days after the bid date. You'll be certifying to provide disclosure forms generated by the IPA to subscriber, et cetera. So there's a number of certifications there. Again, this is another case where the longer, fuller list is in the draft proposal document posted to the website. And finally, as was mentioned, you will be providing some financial guarantee, so some bid assurance collateral at the proposal stage before submitting your bids. And that would be returned to you once the results of the procurements have been considered by the commission. So that bid assurance collateral is going to be in the form either of a letter of credit or in the form of cash, and would be submitted to the companies ComEd and Ameren. So both for the letter of credit and for cash, we would be providing instructions as well as standard forms for the letter of credit for your bank to consider and to use in your letter of credit that would be provided with the Part 2 proposal. The last part of the proposal is the bids and the bid evaluation. We've covered that largely. So the bid would be just the price per rec. So there's no adjustment, escalation, changes per year, et cetera. It's just one bid price that would be applicable to all the recs that are paid to the seller. So all it will be paid for all eligible recs under the rec contract. The projects that will be selected are going to be the lowest price project to satisfy either the target number of recs or the budget set by the IPA for this procurement event. That concludes the section on the draft proposal requirement. Again, details on seller information and representations are in the document that is available now for your review and comments. And with that, I'll turn it over back to Mr. Chi to discuss the contract terms.
Thank you, Dr. Lacasse. I will start off with slide 24 on the key contract terms. As discussed earlier, there are these two RFPs that are running concurrently or under a concurrent timeline. One dealing with solar photovoltaic community projects, and then this particular webcast for the non-solar photovoltaic projects. So these are two separate RFPs featuring two different technologies or sets of technologies, and they will feature separate contracts with separate and different counterparties. So those of you who have been with us earlier this morning on the other webcast, this particular contract, the counterparty will be the Illinois Investor-Owned Utilities of Commonwealth Edison Company or Ameren Illinois Company or both for your projects. So the contract itself is for the purchase of the RECs from your facility, and this is a REC-only contract. There is no payment for energy or capacity. So on the next slide, please. So in terms of what we are after, I'll highlight at least two important differences between the non-solar community procurement, this particular procurement, and the solar procurement. So the first, as it's stated up front here, the technologies are different. So under this procurement, we are after technologies of wind, biodiesel, crops or untreated and unadulterated organic waste, biomass, and tree waste. These are just high-level categories of information. The eligible technologies also include solar thermal technologies as well as hydro, non-new hydro technologies. Those are in the law, but we do not anticipate that it will otherwise meet the requirements of the procurement and have been left out specifically, but feel free to let us know if you feel otherwise. But here are the broad categories sort of to lead you in the direction of what and how to think about this procurement. The other key difference here is that for this procurement, there is a size limit for your project up to a maximum of 2 megawatts. This is an AC rating. This is part of the definition for a community renewable generation project as written in the law. The project itself must be interconnected at the distribution system level to an electric utility, a public utility, a muni utility, or a electric co-op. So what it means inevitably is that it must be located in Illinois. It cannot be in an adjacent state. And the subscribers, which is a key feature of what it means for this to be a community renewable project, the subscribers must receive net metering and must be credited for the value of electricity generated from the community project. In terms of what we are looking in for the development milestones, the date of final interconnection approval must be after, on or after June 1st, 2017. So it cannot be before June 1st, 2017 to meet the definition, our definition of what we consider a new project. Operation of the project itself is expected to begin within 18 months after contract execution. And there will be certain extensions that will be granted for limited circumstances, for example, permitting delays, and also extensions that are fee-based. We are featuring some of the fee-based extension requests and approvals provisions that are also in the other programs run by the agency. So, for example, we are thinking that there could be a $25 per kilowatt hour, per kilowatt extension fee to grant you a 6 months extension, regardless of the reason for why you are asking for that. There could be also a fee-based extension for you to have more time to acquire subscribers. So these are all provided in the draft provisional requirements posted online. You can look at them. This again is just a high level overview to wrap your minds around what we are after. Over on the next slide. So in terms of the delivery terms, we are going to go out for a REC contract for a 15 year delivery term, 15 years after we have received your first REC delivery. So you have time to develop the project, and your project must then be interconnected with the utility and registered with GETS or MRETS. Once you're registered with GETS or MRETS and they create and issue the RECs generated from your project, you must then transfer them to the utility's account. Delivery can start as soon as June 1st, 2020. That's the earliest delivery start date that we are looking at. The procurement, again, the bid date is expected to be sometime at the end of this year. So this leaves some time for you to develop your project and then start delivering the RECs. The date of June 1st, 2020 here is the earliest date. It's not when we expect your project to be energized, interconnected, and registered with GETS or MRETS. There is an 18-month period for you to do so, with some provisions to extend the deadline further. Next slide, please. So here, in terms of the price in the contract, this will be simply your bid price. There will be no escalation of the price. There will be no adders to the price. And this will be just a uniform price based on your bid price applicable to all of the deliveries under the REC contract. So to sort of fix some ideas here as well, when we talk about a community renewable project, we inevitably will introduce the concept of subscribers and the RECs that are eligible for payment are those that are delivered and those that are attributable to the subscribed shares, shares of the facility that are subscribed by customers. So for budgetary reasons, we will also have some sort of a maximum quantity based on a standard capacity factor for the specific renewable source or renewable technology of the project, which we will provide at the later time such standard capacity factor for use, and for you to propose alternatives as well. In terms of the payment, to put most simply, payments are for RECs only, and payments will be for RECs that are delivered. You will deliver the RECs, and those that are eligible are only those RECs that are attributable to subscribed shares. If the RECs are based on shares that are not for the subscribed portion of the project, they are not eligible for payment regardless of whether you delivered them or not. So that's one thing to note. The second is we will have some performance reporting requirements in the contract. We will ask you for a list of your subscribers and information about subscriptions throughout the year. The contract itself will feature true-up adjustments or clawbacks or some form of adjustment, payment adjustments to make sure that we are paying you for actual subscriptions achieved during the year. And the actual subscriptions themselves, we are expecting to be only accounted for at the conclusion of the delivery year, even though we are featuring payments that may be paid out throughout the year as the RECs are being delivered. So to be more clear, for example, if you deliver RECs throughout the year and at the end of the delivery year, we look back and we account for only 60% of the facility being subscribed, then only 60% of the total year's output is what we will be looking at for purposes of payment. If we have overpaid you, we will be looking to claw some of the payments back. So this is what I mean by a true-up adjustments. And a true-up basically will adjust for payments in the future for what has been paid out in the past if there are overpayments that are being made. Next slide. So over on slide 28 here, we will touch on subscribers. This is a very key element of what a community project is about. We here shed some light on what a subscriber means and some information and color on how to think about them. So a subscriber in its most general sense is basically a customer in the service territory of the interconnecting utility. It does not matter whether it's a low-income or a regular customer. For this particular program, we make no such distinction. A subscriber must simply be a customer in the service territory of the interconnecting utility. One thing to note for you is that the interconnecting utility for which the project is interconnected with may not be your counterparty to the contract. They are two separate entities, or they could be two separate entities. But just take note that whoever the customer is of the interconnecting utility may be a subscriber to the project there. No subscriber may constitute more than 40% of the facility's nameplate capacity. So this applies to any single subscriber. The maximum they can subscribe to is 40% of the facility's nameplate capacity. The subscriber itself must participate in net metering or receive net metering from the utility. And if the project itself resides or is located in the service territory of a muni utility or a electric cooperative, then they must certify that they offer net metering comparable to the investor-owned utilities such as ComEd or Ameren Illinois Company. So just take note, these are the features of the subscribers. This is not the seller, but this is the subscriber to the project for which the seller must acquire, and you are only getting paid for the RECs attributable to subscribed shares of the project. The next slide, please. So additional requirements, I touched on the first already, which is that there will be a annual or yearly reporting requirement where you must provide to us information about your subscribers, the list of your subscribers, the interest in the project in terms of the kilowatt, as well as the percentage share that is being subscribed of the project. And we understand that the subscribers could change over time, and the annual report will reflect what has occurred in the prior year and will be used as the basis for how we finalize payments or think about what the final payment would be, noting that some payments would have already been provided along the way as you deliver your RECs, and this will be a check to see whether there are any true-up adjustments that may be required. You must also provide disclosure forms to your subscribers and have them sign and provide them to the IPA. We will talk more a little bit about this as the program evolves, but these are basically the same requirements or comparable requirements that you find in the Illinois Adjustable Block Program that is already off the ground and running. So you have some visibility from those disclosure forms there. You must provide those disclosure forms through the IPA's or its designees program portal. In terms of the marketing guidelines, there will be marketing guidelines that are comparable to those used in the adjustable block programs that you must abide by, not just you as the developer or as the seller, but also your affiliates, any subcontractors, agents, and designees that you have related to this project. They must all abide by the marketing guidelines. Over on next slide. So with that, I will end the presentation portion of this webcast.